ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Park Howell, a business story strategist with more than 30 years of experience in advertising. He's the founder of an award-winning brand and creative consultancy who uses his proven 10-step process, the story cycle, to help business leaders craft and tell compelling stories to engage their audiences and grow their enterprises. In 2010, he was named Advertising Person of the Year by American Advertising Federation of Metro Phoenix. His business storytelling strategy helped launch Coca-Cola's Echo Driving initiative and helped Goodwill of Central Arizona grow from 24 stores, generating $17 million in annual revenue in 2003, to more than 60 stores, earning more than $125 million by 2015. His own podcast, The Business of Story, cracked the top 10 business podcast lists both on iTunes and Yahoo on its second day of airing. Park, thank you so much for joining us today. Over the years in your career, you said you realized that people understand the purpose of their organization, but they don't know how to bring their core brand story to the surface. And can you explain what that means?
Yeah. Well, thank you, number one, for having me on your show. It's great to be here. I appreciate it. And what I've seen over the years, I've been in the advertising world for 30 years and run my own agency for 20 of those years. Quite often, we would get an emerging company. They may be doing anywhere from 5 to 10 million in revenue come to us. And they have a business model that's really working. Their product or service they're selling is growing very quickly. And their biggest lament is we don't have our brand story straight. We don't know what it is. We started off as a mom and pop shop. We've been this technician of just knocking this stuff out and getting it out there. But we are now, exploding nationally. We've got venture capitalists showing up asking us what our story is. And we've got competition that are now taking notice. And we've got to make sure that we can defend our position in the marketplace. So you got to help us figure out what our story is. They know intrinsically that they need this narrative. They're just not quite sure exactly what they're asking for. But that's where it comes down to. They've got their purpose down. Now they got to figure out the best way to sell that through their story.
So it's both a matter of knowing, they kind of know their purpose, but you're saying they don't even know their own story. So it's not just a matter of how to tell the story in a well-crafted manner, but even the what of story is escaping them, but they're able to articulate to you that they need a story. They understand that much.
Yeah. And intrinsically they know that they got to get their story straight. So think about this. It's survival of the fittest. And we go into business and we think, I've got to build the best product, the best service. And here's how I think as a technician, that's going to work. And I'm going to bolt this onto that and apply this thing and put a drawer here and offer this consulting service. And I'm going to push it out there. And it works. And then they modify it and they pivot and it works better and better and better. They are so focused on what they make versus what they actually make happen in their lives with their customers that at one point they're so successful on what they make that they realize that, okay, I've got to put some humanity to this. I've got to figure out, I've got a lot of people asking me what it is exactly we do and why it matters. And I'm not really sure what to tell them. It's sort of that curse of the expert. They've gotten so good at providing this product or service that they haven't taken the time to truly understand, how do I articulate that? How do I put that into a story that makes sense to the commoner that shows up that doesn't get what I do? They just know I'm doing something fairly important.
You know, it's amazing. I love this point of view that you have, I have to say, because I really think that story is so hugely important, and it's the framework for how we understand the world around us. And I always think of, there's a great line in Robert Redford's 3 Days of the Condor where his character is asked what he did and he says, I told them a story. And I was, it's like, with him delivering the line, it's like, yes, that's what it is. And I also think, going briefly political, I think that Trump had a story and Clinton didn't. a story and narrative that was clear and understandable. And I think that that's part of it as well. But anyway, jumping back.
Let me ask you, though, what was the story you heard from Trump?
Well, the story that I heard was you've been left behind, and I see it and I hear it and I'm with you, and it's not fair. It was a story of anger and unhappiness and solution. It was the story of carnival and magic, you know, of magical thinking, ultimately.
P.T. Barnum is what you're talking about there, carnival and magic.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the alternate vision was this wonky lady talking about all these complicated things, you know. That's not so fun. So, which is a nice segue into what makes a story truly compelling.
Well, using that segue, here's what I think Trump did to make his story truly compelling. And it was literally this simple. America used to be great. America is no longer great. I'm going to make America great again. The perfect three-act structure to story. My buddy, Dr. Randy Olson, who wrote a terrific book called Houston, We Have a Narrative, all about the and, but, and therefore, the foundation of story, what I call the DNA of story. I had him on the Business of Story podcast the day after the election, and he talked about...
That must have been so good. I didn't catch that.
You got to hear it. I mean, I got people responding to me from around the world on it because he basically, Dr. Olson, dissected, unpacked what Trump did. And essentially, it was pop culture versus political cronyism. That's what was at stake here in these two different parties. Pop culture won out because the reality TV show guy had such a deep instinct for narrative structure that I don't even know if it was planned, but a lot of his craziness, his P.T. Barnum effect was certainly a part of the whole thing. So what makes a compelling story is, I think, as you said, that carnival magic to be able to connect with people on this very visceral level. I mean, stories truly are the software that drives the hardware of our brains. And as you said earlier, to create meaning in the chaos of being a human being. Story is our ultimate survival tool. And those like a Donald Trump that has this amazing narrative intuition can tap into that. And the trick is, you really want to use it for good and not evil because it's effective in both planes.
Well said. You have your own unique take on what makes a story, and you've taken inspiration from Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey. Can you explain to our listeners what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I got this, you know, I've been doing this for a long time in the advertising marketing world, and our middle son, Parker, went to film school at Chapman University in 2006 through 2010, graduated, and has been living in his one-bedroom downtown Hollywood apartment ever since. He's been doing motion graphics design work and, you know, writing a movie and has a trailer and shipping it around. Just what you do as a 28-year-old, you know, filmmaker.
That's what you do. Yeah, of course.
Well, while he was doing this, I studied. I said, you know, this school isn't exactly cheap. So when you're done with those textbooks, send them to me because I want to see what does Hollywood know that I need to know to be better at my world of advertising, marketing, the dark arts of sales. But you know, like I said, I use it for good, not evil. I focus a lot on social good, environmental work, and sustainability. In fact, I teach this program at the School of Sustainability at ASU around storytelling. But that's when I learned about Joseph Campbell, America's foremost mythologist, and I studied his hero's journey, this 17-step that you see, this universal structure that you see from the apostles used it, Aristotle used it, Shakespeare, Spielberg. It's everywhere around us. And I found, I created a hypothesis that if it's that impactful in the movies we watch and the books we read, then how could I use this for brand strategy and help leaders really live into the right brand story, the authentic brand story, and do good by those that they are offering their products or services to. We boiled it down to this 10-step process we called the story cycle. It's a story cycle system, and it was unbelievably powerful. I mean, it blew me away. I had no idea if it was going to work or not. The first client we used it on experienced 400% growth in their business over the course of about 5 years. And our second one had 300% growth, it was a nonprofit. Anyways, we brought this all together, and something that surprised me in this is I really approached it from a very pragmatic brand business storying realm. But what I found is it touched such a deep basal primal nerve in people that now I work with it with business leaders, business communicators. It goes well beyond just that brand storytelling. It's how people get straight with their own story of what they do in this world, and then how they get others to buy into that story, you know, and help them to prosper from it as well. So it goes way deeper than what I first thought it would be, this nice surfacey brand story strategy thing. And it has taken me all over the world now teaching it. I'm just having a blast with it.
Well, it sounds like almost like a Jungian archetype, right, that you're tapping into. And
yeah, that's actually comes in chapter 6. Of
no process. Way, really?
Enter the mentor. And what I tell brands is you are not the center of the story. I hate to tell you that, narcissistic brand, but it's your audience who is the center of the story. You play a more important role of the brand or of the mentor or guide. You know, you are the Glinda Goodwitch of the North to your customers, Dorothy, or Obi-Wan Yoda to your customers, Luke Skywalker. And in that, we do have them look at the Jungian archetypes, the 12 primary archetypes, and get them to identify with what is the one that is the most potent, powerfully expressed in their brand story. And then we give them up to one or two others that could be supporting archetypes. But I found that was way more effective than sitting around a table like we used to do and say, if your brand was a dog, what kind of dog?
Oh, my goodness.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Yes. Save us from the dog conversation or the car conversation.
Or the drink conversation. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. The archetype that Jung talked about in his, you know, personality archetypes, and then this universal structure to story that mythology is based on, and Campbell underscored, are absolutely woven together. And we're simply using that same sort of thing to help brands really understand who they are and how they can better help people.
So your company works with various industries. It's healthcare, business to business, software, insurance, architecture. I mean, I could list a laundry mm-hmm. list. I have a laundry list written down in front of me and I'm not listing it. So across the board, you can apply this system to all of these different players, and not only these different players, but individual people within these players. It works across the board. It's that flexible, that
yeah,
universal.
Without question. What do they all have in common? What do you and I have in common? You are a female coming out of New York. I'm a guy hanging out here in Phoenix. What do you and I have in common?
We're people.
We're human beings. And story works on such a primal level that it's crazy for brands to look the other direction. Now, what happens where it's really needed most is in the business-to-business sector. And the smarter you are, probably the worse you are at storytelling, because you get caught up in the features and benefits, the PowerPoints littered with graphics and that sort of thing, versus educating people about what you do through lore. You get caught up as that expert. And so what is common across the board is we are all meaning-making machines. We use story to make meaning out of the world happening around us. And the brands that ignore that and just go in with their brochure, you know, filled with their 9-point bullet list of why you should buy, are doing it at their detriment.
So are there challenges that are unique to business storytelling, or are the challenges just to do with how dense and disconnected any brand may be from their story?
Yeah, two very, very, we could do podcasts on each of those questions. Yeah, the big problem, especially in business to business, is that they leave out the conflict in a story. They want to ignore the middle part of the story, the most important part of the story. If you don't have the middle, the conflict going on, the story tension, you literally have no story and you become a bore. So what they do is like, hi, Gabriella, I'm here. I understand you have this amazing podcast, and I want to sell you this really incredible platform that we have now, and you can buy it for $9.95. Just sign right here. Let's go. And like, they have not even remotely touched on your pain points. So what is your journey using, you know, Skype or whatever platform you might be working on? Where is it not working for you? Where's that story tension? And how can I help bridge that gap for you through the stories I tell? It seems like a no-brainer. It seems like just like sales 101, but I am absolutely blown away by how few people engage their audiences or their customers in lore, in story. And I think it's because we were all taught by rote, and so our brains have been hijacked in thinking that we sell by rote and we learn by rote. when if you really want to learn something, you learn it through the stories that are impressed upon you that deliver that data that you need to learn, that your brain can connect the dots. So right. In business to business in particular, you find people just averse to story. That's too gimmicky. That's too squishy. That's too vulnerable. That's not what I'm about. I'm about sales. I'm about the numbers. Let me just sell you something.
It feels inauthentic if we're having a business conversation to tell somebody a story. That feels like a time waste, or it feels uncomfortable. So I guess the people, maybe it's to feel authentic and to own your story, to really live your story, to feel comfortable in your story, so that when you deliver your story, it's a piece of you as opposed to something that you're trotting out. Whereas you trot out data, and of course you trot out data because it's data, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So can any brand have a compelling story? Is there always a compelling story to be had?
If they're doing something compellingly.
Not always.
Well, it is compelling to their target audience, or it should be. Otherwise, they're not going to have a target audience. So they're always got to look for the pain points, of course, the story tension, as I call it, the disruption in the marketplace. In our 10-step process, disruption is chapter 4. You start with the backstory of, and this is, by the way, the story is always about your audience. So what's their backstory and why have you been invited into the conference room to talk with them, or at least got your big foot in the door to talk to them? Number 2 is, who's the hero of this journey? So what do you know about this audience? What is it that they absolutely want out of life that you could help them get? Step number 3 is, what's at stake? So what's at stake if they step across that threshold and buy into whatever it is you're selling them? What do they stand to gain? And what do they stand to lose if they remain in status quo? This is where the excitement of the story comes in. Chapter 4 is about disruption. You have to have a keen sense of the disruption happening in the marketplace, and thus the disruption happening in the life of your audience, your hero, your customer, so that you can be there then as the mentor to make that happen. That's where the compelling nature comes into the story. So you want to figure out what that pain point is, and you want to amplify that pain through chapter 5, which is obstacles and antagonists, and really being able to identify with them what are the enemies they face, everything from their external competition to their internal voices of doom and fear and whatever, because that's very real to them. That's the story they're on. And then how you were there again in chapter 6 as they enter the mentor, you were there to help them cross this chasm by how you are equipped, the product or offering you have to sell, and how you can make their world right again. And then we jump into the following chapters. The road of trials is where you actually get to talk about your features and benefits, but you do it in such as a story journey, not just bombarding them with bullets that will kill any presentation. Pardon that horrible pun.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you got to ask yourself in chapters 8, 9, and 10, you know, what does success look like for them? What does success feel like for them? And that's when you're connecting your shared beliefs with their shared beliefs and values. In chapter 9, and then finally chapter 10 is to be continued, is to build that brand ritual. How do I keep them not only buying for the first time, but keep them coming back for more and watching their story journey expand with every revolution of the story cycle as they are using the product, going from brand awareness to brand adoption to brand appreciation, to the point that you actually then hand off your brand story to them and they become your brand storyteller, invoking the most powerful form of marketing there is, and that's word of mouth marketing, right? Telling the stories of the experiences that they've had with you and your brand. You can only do that if you have a compelling offering and you invite them into your story on their terms, not your terms.
Right. Well, here's a question for you then. One of the challenges in entertainment today, my clients are entertainment brands, and so as television has moved from linear networks to over-the-top services, there's been a shift from brand, like consumer viewing the channel brand, and then versus the program brand. And as people are pirating and looking for content, and certainly Netflix, and they're consuming, binging, it's become really about the show. Is it possible to have a nested brand where you have each show have its own brand, but then still to have the network have a brand that is relevant and has meaning for the consumer? And does it matter if they do or don't? let's say we're looking at FX, and mm-hmm. FX has a slate of programs, American Horror Story, Fargo, Tyrant, you know, they have a series of shows. Does the viewer go to them and say, I'm going to FX because I know about FX, and that's what I know that I'm going to get things at FX that I like, the way, let's say, HBO, Westworld, Game of Thrones. You say Game of Thrones, where is it on? Do people know it's HBO? Does it matter that they know it's HBO?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you have some brands, some love brands. I would say HBO is one of those few where people know the content is HBO content by and large. I'm not convinced that currently, certainly young millennials, know that the content exists, that if you name a show that they could tell you where it was. If you said to them, This Is Us, would they say NBC? You know?
Right. And yeah, so, no, I agree with you. I don't think they can. I think you're right. They're the love brands. HBO's right up there. Showtime is probably there in some aspect. I don't know, man. Anymore, as you pointed out, we binge watch on our terms on Netflix and other places, Hulu. And I think almost the network that it is delivered on is irrelevant because people are going for that particular show. Now, they might say, hey, you know, Netflix has been delivering some good stuff, so I'm going to give this next show a chance.
Well, right. Are they a curator? I guess so. I guess my question as a brand storyteller is linear television, while there still is linear television, where there is right. still this, they want people to tune in, to give it a go, to see what's there. And so in order to do that, they need to have some sort of brand. And how do you create a brand for this linear product when you have all these very highly identified but distinct brands of these programs? You want the programs mm-hmm. to have brands, especially as you've become the producer and you have second stream revenue coming off from licensing down the road when they're, you know, somewhere else. But can you tell a story? Can you tell a story when essentially your Coca-Cola, what's in your Coca-Cola changes every, you know, few weeks?
Yeah, so when you're talking about linear programming, you're talking about NBC, CBS, ABC. Do I have that right? Yeah.
Or cable, anything that you watch where there's commercials.
Yeah. How they stand it? Well, I would first say the networks are going to be in the best position to try to create that community and camaraderie around the brand, probably starting with their network television, buying into the network TV hosts, the news hosts, and that sort of thing. But boy, I don't know. It just seems it's so agnostic anymore that people don't really care about where it comes from. I TiVo all this stuff, so I never watch commercials. I'm in the advertising business. I never watch commercials. I want to watch it on my time, in my terms. I'm a huge NFL lover. I very rarely watch an NFL football game in real time. I record it. I will pop in about an hour and 15 minutes into the game. I can then watch it at my own pace and catch up to it for the last 4 or 5 minutes and see it in real time at the close.
I don't care
what network it's on. But, you know, my story is I don't want to be governed by what the TV, and I don't think it's my own story. I think a lot of people are like this. My kids don't even own TV sets. They watch, they're 33, 28, and 23. They don't own TV sets. They watch everything online. And I don't think they care where it comes from. They just go for the absolute show for that programming. So I think what's incumbent upon that brand is to really own what it is that they are doing. So did I just read something? You would know this better than I, that National Geographic, I think, is going away from some of their programming that actually took them out of their National Geographic mode. Or am I just totally making that up? It seemed like I heard that somewhere and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Here's a brand really trying to put a point, a fine tip on their brand story so that they can stand out in this abundance that we have to choose from.
Yeah, I think that's what we are seeing. I guess where I was thinking or beginning to think about some parallels are when I was growing up, all of a sudden there started appearing these commercials that, you know, you'd have Tropicana orange juice and then they'd say, "We're Beatrice." And it was kind of this creepy thing that would happen. As a kid, I was like, "What is Beatrice? And why is she, you know, what is this? What is this thing?" And it's sort of similar, like, does Unilever, who has all these sub-brands, do they need to have a brand in the public eye? Does Beatrice, I don't even know if Beatrice still exists, those ads stopped, you know, so similarly, do the networks need to have a brand? Do, you know, does, I'd say during linear TV, while they're still trying to get ad revenue, probably yes. But it's a sort of a dual track question I have is one, how relevant do you think that kind of holding company brand can ever be? And B, if it's necessary, and currently it's still necessary, how do you go about, can you apply this same process that you use for the individual brands for a holding company brand?
Yeah, terrific question. So I think, A, yes, I think those holding brands, especially in the TV world, needs to continue to carve out their brand story, which is the meaning. What do they truly stand for? And they probably, I'm no programmer, but I'm assuming there's got to be a thread of that same brand story that weaves itself through all of their different programming. And it's probably anchored by the personalities, the lifetime, you know, morning show personalities that bring that brand story to life. So CNN has a distinctive brand, as does Fox News have a very distinctive brand, as does MSNBC. I think it gets a little bit less clear when you start putting ABC, CBS, and NBC together, but I think it does behoove them to try to carve out some sort of semblance of meaning in the viewer's mind of, if you're looking for this kind of programming that delivers day in and day out, you need to dial into Channel 5, whatever, you know, Channel 5 might be. I think it's getting harder and harder to do that. If you compare it to like a Unilever or Coca-Cola, I think they absolutely have to protect that brand story and probably have to be there, not so much to carve out that people are going to buy a Unilever product, but they're under a microscope. There are so many people coming after them, and NGOs and you name it, especially in the world of sustainability and some of the work I do at ASU, that they have to be on top of that brand story and make sure that it gets reflected through the brands that they purchase and they, you know, make available. I don't know. I think the entertainment industry is a larger, more vast battlefield for mindshare. And I think it's probably more micro mindshare buying into stories. Like, for instance, Game of Thrones, could never get into it. My kids are like, oh, you got to see it. You got to watch it. I couldn't understand what they're saying half the time. And so I was like, eh, no. Nah. Westworld, love it. Totally into it. But then again, you know, we watched Breaking Bad, which I thought was great. Then I had to jump over and watch Downton Abbey as like swabs to clean out my brain.
Yeah.
And I would go to PBS because it was my shelter from my vice of jumping over and watching Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad, was that on AMC Network? Was that right?
Yep. And they actually had some really interesting things. They had a series of interesting shows. And I think what's challenging is that when a show runs its life, then you've got to, you know, was it lightning in a bottle? Did the developers hit on
right.
something by accident, or was it a coherent thing? I mean, you look at USA Network with Mr. Robot, and it's, you know, huge, hugely successful. But what else, you know, is, if that's their brand right now, what else is on that network? And, you know, I can't name anything right now off the top of my head. And I don't know that anybody else, I don't know, you know, I don't know what's in the cultural conversation. I don't know if you have if there's enough.
Well, if you stand around a water cooler, you know, at any large corporation, you'll get 9 different conversations going on about 9 different programs. And most of those programs are really, really great. But of those 9 people, they may only share 1 or 2 of the same programs, that it's so, you know, diverse and diffused now on the quality of programming. That's what has fascinated me, is how so many of these writers have left Hollywood and gone to TV because they have so much more control over the script and the content. And I think it's showing with, you know, in the last decade, TV programming, and that's overall TV programming, including Netflix and whatever, anything but Hollywood programming, has really been quite marvelous. I mean, the storytelling is marvelous, but it seems like, as great as those shows are, they've taken away from the particular brands that are airing them, because I don't know that people remember if it's AMC or CBS.
No, they don't.
They know the show. They know the product.
Well, and what's interesting is the HBO original programs, they all have a mnemonic at the top, a sound-driven piece. So you sort of, and I don't know that you see that with everybody. And I think that that's strangely effective. And they haven't changed it in a long time, sort of the static and the drone and the
yeah.
logo comes up. But they've also had very quality, you know, consistent quality programming and being part of the cultural conversation, being part of the Reverb, getting to be something that is spread virally socially. And that's what you were talking about is the story, you know, creating that story that then you have your brand evangelists, you have your public out there doing your work for you and loving it so much. They're going to buy T-shirts. They're going to buy games. They're going to dress up on Halloween. It's, you know, it's money, money, money.
Yeah. And trying to get that audience involved as much as possible. I'm kind of wondering, and maybe you know this from your line of work, I'm surprised that somebody hasn't come out with a true 24-hour live-produced TV show, making it a thriller that happens online. So you watch it online as it unfolds real-time and then incorporates various social media channels in it that the actors, you know, and the characters are communicating in, and maybe it's an abduction, it's a dirty bomb, this is all going on that you as a viewer can actually participate in.
Well, I think that's probably, you know, that sort of transmedia production is probably going to happen. I think that you're also going to see, sort of like with the augmented reality that you saw with Pokemon Go, I think you're going to see films where you walk around a city and you can unlock bits of story. You know, where you have the experience. I think that people are hungry for experience, and they're also hungry for a sense of play and wonder, and that providing that and doing it in a compelling, authentic way is something that if you do it, people respond. It also is very expensive, though. And mm-hmm. so, you know, there's the rub. Is getting it to work and selling it in and having actually the good story. I mean, back to that, you know, you see a lot of Hollywood films and there's a lot of, you know, cut, cut, bang, but not necessarily story. And so when you see some good story combined with the high production value, that people respond to.
Yeah, I think our mind just absolutely recognizes story structure in that setup, problem, resolution format, because it's how we make meaning to survive out of life. And when producers and creatives get too caught up in the car chases and the explosions and the fast, rapid edits, because our millennial audiences are used to seeing that, you know, in the games they play, that story structure suffers. And I can tell you from everything I've read, I'm no brain surgeon, but everything I've read is that our brains haven't changed over millennia. It's the exact same head atop our shoulders, the same cranium in there. It's just is now being bombarded with all this new technology that we've been brilliant enough to create. But when it gets right down to it, your basic story structure still rises above all of that noise, because our reptilian part of our brain totally gets it. It's like, there it is.
Yes. Although I think that what all this technology has done is our attention span is getting shorter. I think that currently, I was at some talk and they said it's currently that of a goldfish. It's 8 seconds.
Yeah.
It's really short. So in order to grab gear, to get that, and once you've got the attention and you've hooked the person in, then they're with you. But if you fail, and you have a very short window in which to accomplish things, then you're sort of sunk. You know, I've used up a lot of your time, but before we wrapped up, I wanted to talk a little bit about your podcast, The Business of Story, and how that came to be and what you're seeking to do with the podcast.
Oh, well, yeah, thank you for that. How it came to be is... So when I really got into this storytelling thing and I'm like, oh, my God, I got something here. This is crazy. And it just took me down all these different avenues. I reached out to my good buddy, Jay Bear, who at Convince and Convert. And Jay, if you don't know Jay, he's a social media guru. He's one of the most followed guys in the world of social media and how to use it and whatever. I knew Jay when he lived out here in Phoenix. He's now back in the East. And I said, hey, I'm thinking about starting this podcast. Thanks for the tip. I read a blog post he wrote, and he pinged me back and said, hey, you know, I'm building out my own media network with podcasts. Let's bring you on. And so I've been doing this in conjunction with Jay at Convince and Convert. And it's all about helping listeners by connecting them with story artists. So I get like Robert McKee, legendary screenwriting coach. I get directors, actors. I just got off the phone or just got off recording with Michael Gerber, the author of The E-Myth. And he's got came out with a new book called Beyond the E-Myth. What I do is I try to find what I call story artists, people that make a living telling, producing stories. And it could be anywhere from Hollywood to TV to content marketing to small business creation. And I connect them with listeners so that they can learn, how do you use this? How can I ignite this inner storyteller within me so that I can humanize my brand offering and actually connect with people on a much deeper level? And in doing so, they have to kind of get right with their own story. So the authenticity of what they're about as a leader or communicator comes out in the process. It's my way of kind of helping the world say, this is what I've learned. And every time I get to do one of these interviews, I learn that much more. It's like I get a private tutorship that I record and share with the rest of my listeners. But it's all about, as Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss and doors will open where there were only walls before. Well, I have found that the story structure and understanding this ancient art and how it can really bring people to life in what they're doing and sharing that with the world has become, you know, it sounds trite, but a true passion of mine. It's what is driving my professional pursuits these days. And so I do one show every week. We roll it out at businessofstory.com on Monday on Sundays. And I'm just coming up to what our 90th episode. So we've been at it for about a year and a half. And just, it's been growing. We get about, 20,000 downloads a month now, which is good.
That's fantastic.
And it opens my world up to wonderful people like you, I think. If I'm not doing it, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. So that's what it's all about.
It's really interesting. I mean, similarly, what I've been doing, and it's been really fantastic creating webs of people and knowledge points. And I find it really creates aha moments where I'm like, oh, that's a great way to look at it. And, you know, be able to connect people from various fields. And I find it really so fun for me. It's, you know, that's why I do it. I do it for everybody, but also I really enjoy it. So,
yeah, I had a buddy the other day ask me, so, you know, this whole podcasting thing, is it worth it? Are you getting any business out of it? And I go, well, I wouldn't say that people are calling me up and saying, I'm going to hire you because I heard this episode. But what's worth it to me is people reach out all the time and said, wow, I've never thought about it that way. Or, geez, this really helped my business. Thank you. And they would call out particular episodes of people they've heard. You know, who knew I would learn from a screenwriter or a Hollywood improv comic on how to better address my people? So that's the thing that makes it worth it to me. When people are saying, someone on your show changed the way I viewed something and it's had a profound impact on me. That's a win for me.
That is so cool. That is cool. That's really great. So thank you so much again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. You as well, Gabrielle. Right. I appreciate it. Right. Take care.
We've reached the end of our episode, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Park Howell. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.